This critique examines the academic white paper, Life Coherent Internal Medicine, which proposes reorganizing the teaching and practice of internal medicine around the human being's living logic, capacity restoration, and structural coupling, drawing heavily on Maturana biology. The transition from the dense theoretical foundations of Maturana biology directly into bedside clinical tools creates a steep cognitive step that could lose readers who are deeply entrenched in conventional medical paradigms.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at sections 4 and 5 of this paper, it really heavily front-loads all this abstract philosophy.
Right.
You're just immediately hit with incredibly complex vocabulary, terms like autopoiesis, which is, you know, the idea of a biological system continuously recreating itself, and structural coupling or observer-dependent distinction.
Which are huge concepts.
They are. They're profound ideas, but they're presented way before the text actually grounds them in the familiar everyday reality of an internist.
Yeah. It's just pure theory at that point.
Exactly. And by demanding that the reader absorb all this high-level systems biology without any sort of immediate clinical scaffolding, the material really risks alienating the exact audience it's trying to persuade.
Because it's targeting highly pragmatic, conventionally trained physicians, right?
Yes, physicians who are totally accustomed to prioritizing immediate diagnostic and therapeutic action over, like, deep philosophical contemplation.
I mean, we are talking about readers whose daily reality is just governed by diagnostic algorithms, lab values, insurance constraints, and packed waiting rooms.
Right. They don't have time.
So when an internist sits down with his paper, maybe after a 12-hour shift, and the very first major conceptual hurdle requires them to reevaluate the epistemology of observation before they can even, you know, look at a patient, the cognitive friction there is immense.
Oh, completely.
They need to know how this abstract biology actually operates on the clinic floor.
So to resolve this friction, the author really needs to restructure the flow.
Okay, how so?
Well, the text should introduce a brief, highly relatable clinical vignette either right before or simultaneously with the introduction of these Maturana concepts.
Oh, I see. To give them an anchor?
Exactly. The goal is to anchor the abstraction in a tangible, undeniable, everyday medical scenario.
The funny thing is, the material actually possesses these fantastic grounding examples much later in the document.
Right, buried at the end.
Yeah, if you jump all the way down to section 10, there are these breakdowns labeled fatigue made easy or dyspnea made easy.
Yes, and taking elements from those later sections and moving them all the way up to section 4, that changes the entire reading experience.
Because they're seeing the application first.
Right. So for instance, right before defining the abstract concept of structural coupling, the text could introduce a quick profile of an asthmatic patient.
Paint a vivid picture for them.
Yeah, like we see a patient suffering from recurrent asthma exacerbations. They're just constantly in and out of the emergency room.
A very common scenario.
Super common. But then the text explicitly ties these exacerbations to poor housing conditions, persistent mold exposure, cold night air, and just an inability to afford preventative inhalers.
By placing that scenario first, you use that immediate, undeniably real bedside reality to explicitly define what structural coupling actually means in practice.
Exactly. You show the organism-medium relationship in real time rather than just explaining it.
Right.
The social reality of poverty, mold, and poor housing, it doesn't just, like, passively affect the patient. It literally becomes the biological reality of inflamed, hyperreactive airways.
So by presenting the clinical scenario first, you demonstrate to the clinician that structural coupling isn't just some academic thought experiment for a philosophy seminar.
No, it's a rigorous diagnostic tool. It explains mathematically why their current standard medical interventions, like just prescribing another steroid inhaler, are failing.
Of health.
Ah, right.
If they just map the philosophy onto what they already know, how do we ensure they don't completely miss the deeper paradigm shift about the organism's recurrent, continuous interactions with its medium?
That is a crucial point. If the vignette is presented merely as a standard case study about the social determinants of health, they absolutely will miss the paradigm shift.
They'll just glaze over it.
Right. The key is entirely in the framing of that vignette. The text cannot merely list the social determinants like a checklist.
It has to go deeper.
Yes, it must explicitly connect those determinants to the embodied biology of the patient. The author has to use the vignette to show that the damp housing conditions aren't just an external barrier to treatment compliance.
Right, it's not just they can't get to the pharmacy.
Exactly. The environment is actively participating in the continuous biological recreation of the illness.
It's the difference between seeing the mold as something that, you know, triggered an attack yesterday versus seeing the mold and the patient's immune system as an ongoing locked system that is currently building the patient's physiology today.
Yes, and by pairing the familiar case tightly with the new terminology, you elevate the clinician's existing intuition into a disciplined framework.
You're validating them.
Right. You validate their clinical experience. They already know the housing is making the patient sick while simultaneously expanding their interpretive field.
So they stop seeing the patient and the environment as two separate entities colliding and start seeing them as structurally coupled.
Exactly.
Building on how theoretical concepts are anchored for a pragmatic audience, we need to closely examine the framing of the most specific and potentially polarizing biological anchor in the paper, the mitochondrion. The positioning of mitochondria as the primary mediators of the energy gap risks being misinterpreted by skeptical clinical readers as reducing systemic illness to a single organelle, despite the explicit disclaimers in the text.
Yeah, Section 9 introduces this mitoception framework, which is fascinating, but it frames mitochondria as the ultimate convergence point for social stress, inflammation, and energy transformation.
And that's a red flag for a lot of doctors.
It is. I mean, the text clearly states, and I'm quoting here, this does not mean mitochondria are the cause of all disease.
Sure, they put the disclaimer in.
But when a conventionally trained physician reads that multimorbidity, psychological trauma, and environmental stress all funnel down to one biological target, their professional alarm bells are going to ring.
Because historically, mitochondrial medicine has been completely co-opted.
Right, by the wellness industry.
The conventional establishment is highly skeptical of mitochondrial cure-alls or alternative medicine tropes that try to boil down complex systemic failures into a single supplementable organelle.
Like just take this CoQ10 and you'll be fine.
Exactly. And a simple disclaimer paragraph saying we aren't doing that is rarely enough to lower their guards. The moment they perceive reductionism, they might just discard the entire life coherent framework.
To address this vulnerability, the text needs to actively steelman the conventional counterargument within the text itself and utilize a contrasting systemic analogy to vividly clarify the critical distinction between a mediator and a root cause.
So literally write out the skeptic's argument.
Yes. Acknowledge directly that attributing complex systemic failure to one organelle historically borders on pseudoscience.
Just call it out.
Exactly. Validate the reader's caution against reductionism. Say something explicitly like, the reader might rightly be suspicious that we are reducing the vast complexity of human illness to the mitochondria.
That definitely disarms the reader.
And once you've disarmed them by agreeing with their skepticism, you introduce an analogy to redefine the mitochondrion's role.
Like what?
Think of a macroeconomic supply chain. The text can explicitly state that the mitochondria are not the cause of the biological factory shutting down.
Right.
The original cause of the shutdown might be a massive social stressor, a systemic viral infection, or severe psychological trauma. But the mitochondria act as the currency exchange where that broad systemic breakdown manifests locally as an energy gap.
Ah, I love that. The factory doesn't close because the currency exchange is evil. It closes because the global market crashed and the exchange simply ran out of funds to convert.
Precisely.
It just translates the broad systemic conditions into a local cellular failure.
It proves that the organelle isn't the singular disease itself. It is merely the site of translation.
So if we want to make this even more visceral for a clinician who deals with like mechanics and fluid dynamics of the body, what if we use a mechanical analogy?
Let's hear it.
Is this similar to blaming a car's alternator for a breakdown when the reality is that the car's central computer system is sending erratic signals due to an extreme drop in external temperature?
Oh, that's good.
Like the alternator is failing, yes. It is the immediate reason the car is losing power and the headlights are dimming. But it is the mediator of the harsh environment, not the origin of the flaw.
Yes. And in that car scenario, If the mechanic just swaps out the alternator, or in the patient's case, if the doctor just prescribes a mitochondrial supplement, the car still dies the next morning.
Because the temperature is still freezing.
Exactly. The temperature is still freezing, and the computer is still glitching. The underlying environmental stress hasn't changed at all.
That's what happens when you prescribe a supplement without fixing the organism-medium relationship.
The system will inevitably fail again because the root stressor is totally untouched.
It's just a Band-Aid.
Right. By using an analogy like the failing alternator or the currency exchange, the text beautifully illustrates the difference between an energy deficit, like simply running out of gas, and an energy gap, where the raw inputs might be present, but the system's capacity to transform them into usable work is totally overwhelmed.
It forces a perspective shift.
It proves to the reader that focusing on the mitochondria in this specific framework is an expansion of systems thinking. It forces you to look at the environment overloading the organelle, rather than reducing the problem down to the organelle alone.
Okay, so once physiological mediators like mitochondria are securely framed without triggering clinical skepticism, the reader is tasked with taking action on these systems through the wise perturbation step, which brings us to the operational completeness of the clinical loop itself. The concept of wise perturbation within the life-coherent clinical loop currently lacks the specific operational boundaries needed to prevent it from becoming a subjective catch-all for any well-intentioned intervention.
Yeah. This is a major functional gap when you actually try to apply the clinical loop.
Because it sounds good in theory.
Right. In section 7, the text defines wise perturbation quite broadly. It describes it as an intervention that reopens viability with the least harm, whether that intervention is pharmacological, surgical, social, or environmental.
Which sounds like what doctors already try to do.
Exactly. The issue is that this definition isn't rigorously differentiated from standard everyday conservative management.
Without a clear, testable boundary, the reader is going to struggle to understand exactly when a standard, guideline-directed medical treatment crosses the line from a helpful, necessary intervention into an unwise perturbation.
Right.
If a clinician can simply read the definition and say, well, I always prescribe medications with the least harm in mind, therefore all my perturbations are already wise, the concept loses all its power as a disruptive clinical tool.
That is the danger. The material needs to provide concrete, mathematical, or physiological boundaries that are tightly tied to the paper's concept of adaptive reserve.
How do they do that?
The author must clearly define the threshold that separates a wise perturbation from an unwise one, using the patient's actual biological capacity as the measuring stick.
So we need to anchor this concept to the physiological reality of the patient's current state.
Yes. The text should detail a highly specific clinical scenario, highlighting this exact boundary.
Let's use an example from the paper.
Okay. Let's look at the frailty phenotype mentioned in section 10.4.
Okay.
Picture a patient exhibiting unintended weight loss, profound exhaustion, and a visibly slow walking speed.
A classic frail patient.
Right. The text should introduce a scenario involving an aggressive HbA1c target, say, pushing for a 6.5%, which is entirely mandated by conventional diabetes guidelines for this specific disease state.
So the doctor looks at the algorithm. The algorithm says the blood sugar is too high, so the doctor adds a third diabetes medication. Standard care.
Completely standard. But the text needs to explicitly show the biological math of why that standard care becomes an unwise perturbation.
The hidden cost of the drug.
Yes. It must demonstrate that the energetic demand of metabolizing multiple aggressive medications, combined with the physiological stress of the drug and the constant underlying risk of hypoglycemia associated with tight glycemic control, all of that actually exceeds the frail patient's narrowed adaptive reserve.
So the intervention is technically correct according to the disease-specific guidelines, but it is a biological overreach.
Exactly.
It demands a level of cellular energy and resilience that the patient literally no longer has.
By detailing the scenario step by step, you defined an unwise perturbation not as a moral failing of the doctor, but as a physiological mismatch.
It's an objective measurement.
Yes, it is an objective imbalance between the biological cost of the intervention and the available reserve of the organism. The patient's system simply cannot afford the treatment.
Wait, I want to challenge the uniqueness of this concept, because a reader looking at the frail diabetic patient might think this is just semantic.
How so?
Well,
Isn't WISE perturbation essentially just a semantic rebranding of the Hippocratic Oath's ancient directive, first do no harm? How do we make sure this step provides a genuinely new analytical tool, rather than just serving as a philosophical reminder for doctors to be careful with frail patients?
That's a fair question, but first do no harm is largely a passive preventative directive.
Meaning?
It tells you what not to do. It sets a baseline of non-maleficence. But WISE perturbation, when it's properly bounded by the concept of adaptive reserve, is an active analytical calculation.
Okay, I see the distinction.
It requires the clinician to assess the systemic energetic cost of a treatment against the specific, measurable capacity of the organism at that exact moment in time.
It's a dynamic equation, not a static rule.
Exactly. It's not just about avoiding universally toxic drugs. It's about recognizing that a drug that is life-saving when the patient has a wide adaptive reserve, say, when they were 60 and robust, becomes actively destructive when that reserve narrows at age 80.
Because the biological context changed.
The drug didn't change, the guidelines didn't change, but the structural coupling of the organism changed. This demands a continuous reassessment of what the patient can tolerate today. That is a far more sophisticated and targeted clinical tool than a simple ethical oath.
Wow, yeah. It transforms a philosophical stance into a measurable clinical metric.
Exactly.
All right. To recap the main points of this critique. First, we explored the necessity of restructuring the material's flow to anchor the abstract Maturanan theory with early, relatable clinical vignettes, preventing the alienation of pragmatic readers. Second, we addressed the need to steelman the clinical skepticism surrounding mitochondrial medicine by utilizing systemic analogies to firmly define the difference between mediators and root causes. Finally, we examine the importance of operationalizing the concept of WISE perturbation by setting firm, testable boundaries based on a patient's adaptive reserve.
And just to summarize the actionable suggestions for the listener to implement, move the made-easy vignettes like the asthma and housing example much earlier in the text to ground the philosophy immediately.
Right.
The roughly address and validate reader's skepticism regarding organelle reductionism by actually writing the counter-argument into the text and using analogies like the macroeconomic currency exchange or the failing alternator.
Love that one.
And finally, provide explicit physiological examples, such as the metabolic cost to the frail diabetic patient, to clearly demonstrate exactly when standard medical guidelines transition into unwise perturbations.
We invite you to implement these structural and thematic changes and submit your revised white paper back in for a follow-up critique. By refining these foundational elements, the material will ensure that when clinicians look through this new framework, they aren't just swapping one microscope for another, but are finally able to step back, look through the window, and see the entire living patient in the context of their world.